Good evening and welcome. I think there's, are these reserved seats at the front actually reserved still, or can we move some people up? So if people are standing at the back, if you'd like to come up and sit at the front. No one wants to sit at the front, I know that, but that's the way it goes. Good evening, my name is Chris Waddell. I'm the Associate Professor at the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton, and I'm also a board member of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and it's in that role that I'm here this evening. On behalf of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, I'd like to thank you all for coming out. I'd like to welcome you to the annual JTalk event that CJF sponsors in Ottawa. I think I can say annual now that it's the second year. And third year, that's right. And we'll be the first of, the third of many to come. My job is to, as I said, thank you for coming, and to note that this evening wouldn't be happening without the support of some of our sponsors. Those include the presenting sponsor, Shaw Communications, JTalk series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, a venue sponsor, the National Arts Centre, and in-kind support that comes from CNW, Canada Newswire, and from CPAC. By the way, CPAC is recording the event this evening. It will be telecast on CPAC. We don't know when yet. We will put a note on the CJF website telling you when we know when it's going to be on aired. Parliament doesn't sit next week, so that means there's lots of vacant space normally occupied by the House of Commons, so maybe it might show up next week, and then Parliament, as of the middle or of late June, won't sit until who knows when, maybe 2016. So there may be lots of opportunities to see this on television time and time again over the next few months. I should also add a couple of housekeeping notes. There will be a reception to which you're all invited here after we finish this evening. As well, for those who want to do more than just listen to our great panel this evening, we have, feel free to tweet. Using the event hashtag CJFTalk, and as a related note, and I don't want to put any pressure on those people who are tweeting, but the event is not being live blogged or being webcast, so the world is depending on you to tell everyone what's happening tonight, so leave that on your shoulders. Finally, let me introduce our moderator for the evening, Tom Clark. Of course, I really don't have to introduce Tom to anyone in this audience. He's the chief political correspondent for Global National and also has his weekly political program, the West Bloc. He's reported from around the world over the last many years, and he first started reporting from Parliament in 1971. In fact, he's covered every federal election since 1974. By my count, October 19th will be his 13th election. I don't know whether that's lucky or not, but let Tom figure that out. And he's the perfect person to be the moderator for this evening and introduce our panel for a subject, What Stories Swing Votes. So with that, over to Tom.
Thank you, Chris. I was in a great mood right up until that introduction. And I've been reminded of my aging and my frailty. Good evening and welcome to you all, and I'm going to introduce you to the panel in a second. This should go well. Only because I think these guys have got some experience doing this. I want to, before we get into it, I know that the biographies are in your program and I urge you to read them, but I can say not only do I know all of our panelists, I respect them immensely and they're all friends of mine. So that,
for now,
but that's Ottawa for you, you know, with friends and family and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, Susan Delacourt, we all know Susan, had a remarkable career with the Globe and Mail, went on to have an even better career at the Toronto Star, still does, writes a column. Her most recent book, Shopping for Votes, is sort of the seminal book, I think, on modern politics and about what we're going to be, part of what we're going to be talking about tonight. It's too extensive to go on, but she has won awards, literary awards, journalism awards. She truly is one of the great journalists here in Ottawa and in the country. Frank Graves, if you don't know ECOS Research, you should. ECOS has really sort of written the book on polling for decades now. Frank, who is a shy, retiring, non-controversial type of guy, never getting in trouble with anybody, nevertheless continues to be on the forefront of sampling not only what we what we think as a nation on a variety of issues, but also is on the forefront of the developing world of politics and where it's all going. And so he's an absolute natural fit to have here tonight. David Hurley, again, if you don't know him, you should. He's with the Gandalf Group. But David has got a long and storied career in politics. He, of course, worked very closely with Paul Martin and was an integral part of the success of that Liberal administration, especially when it came to balancing the budget, something we all know about these days. And David now consults both to industry and to unions, to all sorts of groups, as a matter of fact, on how to survive crisis. And if you're a liberal, who else better to know how to what a crisis is? And finally, Adam Radwanski, one of the journalists I respect tremendously in our business. I think one of the brightest young columnists that we've got, and young, I'll use young, because you paid me to say that, and I'm willing to take the money. Of course, politics columnist for the Globe and Mail, has worked extensively not only in Canada and in lead roles for the Globe and Mail in their coverage of federal campaigns, but of course also in Washington, the United States. Their biographies are far more impressive than what I've just gone through, but feel free to read them. But that's your panel. I just wanted to start this conversation by thanking somebody who's not here tonight, but who has really sort of lifted us all up in a way that was unexpected and terrifying at the same time. And of course, I'm talking about Corey Tenike. And we'd like to thank Corey for stepping up and stepping forward 2 days ago by announcing that they were going to boycott, not attend, whatever word you want to use, the consortium debate for this election campaign, and thus then seized control of the agenda. And Corey now, and I'm sure you're all good with this, Corey is now going to decide what we are going to have for debates and the format and who's going to participate. Let me start off with the panel, and feel free to jump into that one right away if you want. But on a more general level, as Chris so kindly pointed out, the first election campaign that I traveled on was in 1974, and every campaign since then. At the beginning of the campaign, I've always heard the same thing. This campaign will be nothing like the last campaign. This will set a new standard for politics. That's since 1974, and it's been going on election after election. This time, though, I think I believe it for the first time. This time, I get a sense that this really will be different. And we're going to be taking a look at it from not only the perspective of journalism, but also from the professions that both David and Frank represent as well, because they're integral parts of this whole puzzle. But if I could just throw generally a question out there, Susan, how different, and if it is going to be different, why is it going to be different? Give me one simple reason why this is going to be different.
Well, I will, I'd refer you to Hillary Clinton's campaign launch a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Hillary Clinton launched her bid for the presidency of the United States without a press conference, without a prepared text. She did it on YouTube. She did it without a press bus. She basically said that she could run her campaign without the traditional accoutrement of the media. And I think that was an important signal of where we're headed. I also would like to thank Corey Tenike too, because I think, I do think it's going to focus our minds. And I've been big on this since I wrote the book, but when I went back and did looked at the way elections were covered in the 1970s, when television and polling were really just grabbing the influence, I was amazed at how good the coverage was. I think a couple of people who did that coverage are in this room. The coverage was thorough. We understood what polling was bringing, what the influence of television was. I do not think that journalism has kept up with the way campaigns are run now, which is there's the air war and the ground war we're familiar with. But I think the mass market model of politics has been broken. And that micro-targeting, as we know, is the new model of politics. And this debate issue really focuses that question. The debates are all about mass marketing and talking to Canadians as one mass market. But the Conservatives have been big on talking to Canadians in pockets and targets. And I think we journalists, if we want to still be relevant in this campaign, better get good at covering micro targets, pockets, and the tiny little campaigns.
Let me jump in and ask David, I'm just jumping over Frank for a second, but because David, this, in your experience both with Kathleen Wynne and with Paul Martin, you were at the center of deciding these things and deciding how these formats, how taken aback were you by the sudden rupturing, probably for all time, of the way we do debates during campaigns?
Well, I'm not sure that discussion is over yet, by the way, and I'm not sure that we're not going to see consortium televised debates with the Prime Minister in attendance at them yet. My sense is he needs them more than Trudeau does, and so he'll show up where Trudeau shows up ultimately. But I think, you know, Susan makes the point about micro-targeting, and I think that that's part of what they're doing. Is they want to have debates in discrete circumstances about discrete subjects where they can control that. My view is, and I think the Kathleen Wynne election campaign is a very good example of that, that micro-targeting only works if there is not a meta-narrative to the campaign. And that if there is a big story, a big narrative around the campaign, that the micro-targeting becomes less important and gets sublimated to that big narrative. So that could be one of their motivations. I think another part of their motivation in doing that is probably to do to the debates what I think that the tourists have become, leaders' tourists have become, which is kind of a gaffe watch that doesn't really attract any attention or interest unless somebody makes a mistake at one. And if you have a series of debates that are going to go untelevised and largely unnoticed by the general public, the only attention they would attract is if somebody were to make a mistake at one of them that would then get reported back through the mainstream media. So I think it's an audacious play on their part, but it's just a play on their part, and I don't think that everybody in the system is in any way compelled to go along with it. Despite my friend Jamie Watt's column in the Globe today.
And I was waiting for somebody to bring that up. And Frank, again, I'm flying over you to Adam, but because David just said something that tweaked my interest in what Adam may think about this. You've had a lot to do with the planning of how the Globe covers campaigns.
Well, I won't overstate that, but yeah.
Okay. You've had some role in the planning of this, but obviously as a political columnist, you have a particular take on it. And so on. David brought up the whole question of the leaders' tours, which have been the staple going way, way back into the mists of the 1970s. Has the leaders' tours, in terms of a journalistic exercise, outlived its usefulness?
So I should say off the top, I don't speak for the Globe on that one, and I don't know where we've landed on this. I see Globe editors sort of lurking around here, so I should make that very clear.
Can I make something clear? Susan doesn't speak for the Star. I don't speak for Shaw. Frank doesn't speak for himself, and David doesn't speak for Gandalf. So there we go.
Yeah. So I don't know where we've landed on that. What I can say from my own experience with it, I mean, I've had a couple of entry points on that side of things. And one, I think sort of at the height of sort of tour madness in terms of adapting to it in the new era, in 2008, in the 2008 federal election, I was helping run our online coverage of that campaign. And in that, I was more doing the commentary side of things, but I was seeing all of the files that were coming in from all of our reporters. And, excuse me, what we had, you know, was probably 3-4 files a day from some of these folks who were really good reporters, and frankly, we weren't using their skills properly at all. You know, it could have been one story, one wire story could have covered everything they were saying. You know, Stephen Harper got off the bus in Belleville and said, you know, that he's going to bring in the Accountability Act. Okay, everybody knew that already. So I think, you know, that got extreme. I think we've dialed back from that already. I don't think we had that in 2011 to that extent, which is healthy. Now the question is, do we cover it at all? Mm-hmm. I think we still have to a point. My other entry point was in the provincial election. Now, I never rode the buses full-time in either Ontario election I covered. I hopped on for a couple of days, get a feel for it, get back off again. But I do think, you know, in Ontario, it probably wasn't totally necessary. I'm not sure buses should exist. You know, half of the electorate is, more than half the electorate is in driving distance from right downtown Toronto. Most, you know, half of it is in the GTA. You know, a lot of the rest is within 2 hours. It's just a construct that we've maintained. Nationally, I think there are still differences between what somebody says and what somebody does and how you know, Stephen Harper or Justin Trudeau or Tom Mulcair plays in Vancouver versus Toronto versus Newfoundland. And I do think there's some obligation to get a handle on that. What I don't think it can be anymore is kind of the be-all and end-all. It doesn't matter the way that it used to. You know, we can now see all these things. They're all streamed, all of that. Journalists aren't going to give you as unique a perspective. And I think we've all realized that the messaging is diverse enough now that in some ways, they're really just doing that to fill the leaders' time. I mean, one of the key questions, if you don't do a tour like they do anymore, is what do you do with the leaders? And I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, the last thing I think...
Sending them on a holiday sometimes.
Yeah, that would be... Yeah. The campaign manager would probably like that, right? I mean, that's... You know, the last thing they want is them lurking around the campaign office all day looking over their shoulder, right? I mean, that it's something for them to do. We have to pay attention. It's kind of a gaffe watch. But I think we're becoming increasingly aware that we have to watch everything else that's happening. When you ask what the big difference is between this campaign and 2011, I think one of the biggest differences, maybe a bigger difference than what the campaign will look like, is how differently we might cover it. Because I think there's been a growing awareness in the last 4 years or so. You know, because we're more aware of the growing... of the different ways the party's message, because we're aware that this government in particular does not rely on the mainstream media the way that it used to, or the way the governments used to, because we've seen a couple of election results that have been surprising or that seem to come out of nowhere, I think there's a growing awareness that we have to stop covering it quite the way we used to and be a little more curious.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because, and Frank, I've done this really deliberately. I've gathered this basket of stuff now that we've talked about so that you can just shoot wildly at any topic that you want, but we've got micro-targeting debates on tours that don't matter. I mean, if I could put it all into one sentence for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. and I'd like to also note that I agree with Corey that he's a great Democrat and that this is will have a salubrious impact on coverage, I'm sure.
But think the only person on the panel not to thank Corey tonight for anything.
Yeah, yeah. I would like to think about the possibility of a campaign and the coverage of that, which didn't include the traditional, you know, tour leaders bus or plane or whatever. And I'd like to sort of look, because I've been looking at this for some time, at how that might be affected when we think about three major types of changes going on there in different institutions, beginning with journalism and the media. And in kind of refreshing myself for tonight, I went back and looked at Robert Kaiser's fantastic essay on the bad news about the news, which was an essay in the Brookings Institute. He's a former editor of the Washington Post, involved in things like the breaking Watergate and so forth. And he charts just how dramatic the decline in the influence and power of journalism in the news has been, looking at things like the fact that revenue sources now are a third of what they were at the beginning of the century, that the newsrooms are half the size of what they've been. And you start thinking about this, and I started looking and comparing how citizens inform themselves and the relative balance between the institution of the news, which held things into account, and provided information, and I go, this has to be, you know, a major source of concern. And I'm not sure what the answer is. Maybe some of the whiz kids in Silicon Valley are figuring out how to generate revenue from a digital world, because we're now getting more people reading news and politics on digital sources, but it's still about 10% of the revenue, and 90%, which is dwindling, comes from that. So that's a huge issue about how does we, and implying into areas like polling, we used to have newsrooms which would have policy experts on various files of the day, like healthcare that they covered during the elections, but also polling expertise, so that you wouldn't see the kind of free-for-all that you see today. Now, the second thing that's changed dramatically over that time period, I think it was even before I was covering these things, that Jimmy Carter's pollster had introduced the notion of a permanent campaign, something that Susan's talked about, how that's come to fruition, I don't know if that's the right metaphor, in the new permanent campaign, which goes on all the time, which is massive, big business, wed to even bigger business, which is connected to it in a number of of ways which are possibly not savory. And certainly if we were to chart this against how that's being responded to by the citizenry, we'd have to acknowledge that this new kind of predator-prey permanent campaign of dark ops and get out and keep home the boat and so forth may be effective, but it comes in against a backdrop where if we look at the third area, I'd like to look at what's happened to the citizens themselves, we've never seen trust so low. It would be hard to imagine that the numbers could go any lower. The incidence of people who said they couldn't trust governments in the salad days of the 70s and 80s was in the 80% range. It's now fallen below 20% in both Canada and the United States. Other barometers of democratic health suggest that we're on the verge, if not into, a legitimacy crisis, which is even worse when we start peeling this across generations. And so when we look at the issues, and we will find, for example, that our people we speak to will tell us overwhelmingly that things like social media, I looked at some of the data I had going back 20 years, fully 7% of people were using the internet as a source of information on politics in 1995. That number is up around 85% today. I actually presciently said that it was a fad in 95 and wasn't going to go anywhere. Another good call. No, I didn't say that. But when we look at the splits now, the consumption of news, which still remains through newspapers and electronic media, the principal source, but it's so it's down across all age cohorts, and it's down dramatically as we move into younger citizenry. What's also different about younger citizenry, not only are they not consuming news in traditional ways, they're not voting. If we saw those trends continued, and all the evidence suggests it would, we're moving from, frankly, a democracy, which is the rule of many, to an oligarchy, because the majority of young people, and it looks like they're going to continue this as they go through this, are not voting, either because they're encouraged not to do so or because of apathy. So, you know, you have to look at all this and say, it's not really, it's really troubling to see where all of this has arrived. And it seems that it's something that's gone outside of the control of citizens to alter.
Well, the challenge for us is to figure out what to do with this dog's breakfast that you've just spelled out for us. But let me, I want to circle back both David and Susan on this one, because what's come up, and Adam brought it up, the question of the leaders' tour and the leaders themselves. And David, you know, let me just map out for everybody, so you all understand the dilemma, I think, that news organizations are facing. When you go on a leader's tour, it is going to cost you about $15,000 a week, once you add in your costs. And for
per
most
person.
Of the time, per person.
Per person.
And most of the time, you're sitting on a Greyhound bus traveling between small towns in southern Ontario. It is the most expensive bus trip in the world.
And least fun.
And the least fun. So there's the cost factor, for one. There's the simply the numbers. Do we have those type of numbers anymore that we can dedicate to something that produces, as Adam has rightly said, and I think Susan agrees, is that, you know, in news, as you know, the leaders' tours produce maybe one paragraph, if that. And a lot of the time, it's Stephen Harper got out of the bus and said hello. And that is it. That's, you know, because they took us to a suitable background. I don't mean to say that it's just him. All the tours do this all the time. So, David, let me start with you and then come to Susan on this. What does it do to the political construct if, for all sorts of different reasons, the media says we are not going to become props or potted plants anymore on this Kabuki theater tour of Canada run by the leaders and the parties. We're going to do this independently. How dramatically would that change things, or perhaps not at all? I don't know.
Well, I think it would be a pretty dramatic change. These things are startlingly toxic, dysfunctional affairs, the leaders' tours, is you have this group of journalists who are cynical and about what they're covering and are wary of being manipulated, traveling around with this group of people who loathe the journalists because they're out to kill them and are trying to manipulate the journalists. And periodically, everybody has to stand around in a bar and pretend that they like each other, and they're getting along well. It's a very odd, awkward
And we pay $15,000 a week for the privilege.
$15,000 to do it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they produce genuine news. Every election campaign, the tours produce genuine news. So I guess you could get it through a pool, or you could get it in different ways. But there is going to be news made on that tour. I know I've been out of it for quite a while before I did the Wynn thing, and the thing that our tour people really taught me is that there's no hope of controlling what the media covering the tour will say, but you can control what they're talking about, and the most important thing is the visual. We spent an extraordinary amount of time coming up with the visual that would guarantee that the media had to run it. And having the best visual of the day and getting that on, because that was the only real way you could use the tour to transmit your message. I suspect, though, that even if the national media stopped covering the tours, that they would still occur, and because this is what I learned in the Martin campaigns, which is that I thought going into those campaigns that the tours didn't matter at all, and that you could really hold these events in a television studio and it would have the same impact, but it turns out that that isn't true, that the local coverage matters a lot, and the local issues matter a lot, and that you can actually track in your nightly polling tracking when you have gone to British Columbia, and if your leader has resonated in British Columbia and said something that mattered, or that his presence or her presence there in and of itself made a difference. So I assume that the leaders would still continue to travel, personally, I think it would be, I understand the finances of it, but I think to the trends Frank was talking about, I think it would be a further diminution of the role of the national media in orchestrating for us what a common set of facts are.
So, Susan, far be it for me to be one of those cynical reporters who sat around pretending that we like the manipulators, but just to take apart or deconstruct what David just said. He said news happens on a tour that is highly manipulative and phony. And that while the media has little impact, nevertheless, the numbers go up every time we write about something. So I see just a host of contradictions. But from a journalist's perspective, wade into this same swamp.
I was actually just, this has only just occurred to me, but when I first started political reporting, we were always warned not to assume that your audience knew the story. Like, you had to start from everything all over at the every article I had to explain what Meech Lake was, et cetera, et cetera. And we always had to remind the politicians hey, you know what, this sounds like an inside story to you guys. I think what's flipped in recent years, especially in Ottawa, not so much at Queen's Park, I don't think, is that the journalists now are talking as though this is a game that everybody has been listening, knows what happened yesterday. And the politicians are the ones who are talking to people like they're 3 years old, right? That they've actually, I was quite struck when I was doing the book but by something Patrick Muttart said. And that, again, everybody knows who Patrick Muttart is? Just I'm coming into the thing halfway through. Patrick Muttart, Harper's marketer-in-chief, explained to me that before the campaign they did, the 2006 campaign, they did stats on consumption of political news. And they found out, and this was very generous, that only 50% of Canadians consumed any kind of political news, any kind. And that was, they were including people who were reading political news on those subway crawls. But 60% of Canadians vote, and that so that 10% in close elections, and David and Frank are the numbers guys here, but that 10% who don't know anything about the campaign, who are not reading us, are deciding the campaigns. And I think we journalists have to get better at finding that 10% and maybe not informing them, but finding out what's moving them anyway. And my reaction when Muttart said this, I've joked about this before, was two reactions. One was a bit stunned to find out that only 50% of people cared about the stuff I cared about. But the other was relief, because I thought they'd been talking to us like we were idiots. You know, the repeating slogans over and over again, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think they weren't. They were talking to that 10%. And I think in the next campaign, the next election as it comes up, the parties have been doing lots of research on voters. They know who's already, again, these guys know this better than I do. They know who's already in their camp. What we have to get better at is focusing on the vote that's moving around, where it's moving, and why it's moving.
So could I ask Adam then, in that regard, what do journalists like you and Susan, myself, have to do, whether it's to reach that 10% or just, you know, to David's point, and I was being flippant when I was dissecting him before, but he brings up a very important point, and that is how much do we matter in the process?
I mean, reaching that 10% is probably ambitious for us. I mean, to Susan's point about that 10% existing, I mean, it struck me covering the Ontario campaign last time that it would have been possible for somebody, maybe even somebody who voted eventually, to have been all but unaware there was a campaign happening during it. I mean, they probably don't have, you know, if you don't have cable TV anymore, sorry, if you don't have a newspaper subscription, sorry to us, if you, you know, you don't have a home phone line, you know, all of your news and intake is basically curated to your interest, it is possible to tune out entirely. So kind of the fundamental challenge for parties, at least to a point, is to reach those people, because some of them may be their potential supporters. I think the challenge for us, partly, as Susan said, is be ambitious about trying to understand how they're trying to reach those folks, what messages are delivered there, know that it may be totally different from the messages that are delivered through the mainstream media, track those down, talk to campaign people and understand what their strategies are and so on. And I think that's what I was saying about the curiosity. I mean, I think we have to be more curious because we can pretend that the campaign is the one we're seeing, but that's only, at this point, a sliver of the campaign. In terms of our impact, I guess I like to think, in terms of what relevance we have, that there's kind of a multiplier there, that, you know, we may only have a relatively small percentage of the population watching the evening news, reading the Star, reading the Globe, whatever, but that I like to think that at least those folks may be people who talk to other people. They may get, you know, somebody who's passingly interested might ask their more interested relative around the table or friend or whatever what they think. And so I think there is some relevance there. And I think, again, to use that relevance properly, we really do have to be ambitious with understanding what the messages are that are out there, what the real campaign is, and hopefully give people a better understanding of what they're seeing, and hope that that kind of multiplies outward a bit, and we're enhancing the understanding of maybe more than just our own most devoted followers or readers.
I may say this is sort of one of the stages of denial, you know, about death, but the Pew Research Center in the United States has just done, and I recommend to anybody to pick it up, read it, you can get it online, on the state of the media. And it's fascinating. Network news in the last 2 years has increased 14%, contrary to the narrative that's out there. So, Frank, this is interesting because you understand, as does David, but you understand this group, this elusive group that we're talking about from the other side. You know what they think, you know where they are, you know how they matter. So if I was to turn it around on you and say, okay, well, help us out here a little bit, Frank, how do we, as journalists, reach those people who may have tuned out, or is it worth reaching them that have tuned out?
I think reaching those who've tuned out is a very difficult challenge, and frankly, with the resources available today, is a bit of a mug's game. I just think there is a new generation, some have called it the precariat, they're having a hell of a time getting traction in the labor market, don't get involved in politics or democracy, and the tools available to change that are frankly quite limited. But I would like to at least be a little cautionary on the idea that it's so micro-targeted that there's 10% or these kinds of numbers. In fact, I think there are more than 50% if you follow readership numbers and so forth. There's still more than 50%, 80% of people still read a newspaper at some point, and it's pretty hard to read a newspaper while defining something in politics, and whether it's social desirability or not, 80% of people tell me that they follow politics relatively regularly, and that's not down, although the ways they do it are. But if you look at something, let's just consider, for example, the last Alberta election. And if it's really a 10% factor, it kind of flies in the face of what happened there. We saw a massive transformation of the Alberta political landscape almost overnight. It was, you know, it wasn't, and if we look at it in hindsight, we see some very dramatic shifts in some very specific groups. So for example, the university educated. The NDP had a 31% advantage with the university educated and had a similar advantage with the college educated, who for a long time have not been unified with the university educated. That was a huge key to that victory. That's a very large part of the spectrum, almost half of the population that moved from somewhere else. And let's just talk about the overall movements. The NDP had 9% in the last election. They got 41. You know, so these are huge movements. Why did they go to the NDP rather than the Liberals, who had 14%? Important questions. What was appealing to that particular large group of educated people who may have been growing increasingly fatigued with a lot of the message they were hearing from a kind of a conservative narrative? The other group that changed massively during that election was the labor vote. They were close to 60% of both public and private sector unions voted for the NDP. You take that portion of the population out there, the race was pretty close. Anyway, I do think there's still room for big movements, and that often those can be very decisive. Although I do believe that there is all kinds of added sophistication going on. I found on the issue of analytics and big data, there was a really interesting study by two Harvard professors who did the retrospective, very sophisticated econometric analysis of what the Republicans and Democrats achieved with all of their efforts. And of course, the Democrats used all the science lab and so forth, and the Republicans used more traditional methods. Well, guess what? They found in their very sophisticated modeling that both of them achieved very significant effects, about 8% turnout advantage, but there was no difference across the two approaches, one of which is more traditional. And the fact that we're talking shorter and shorter terms of the politicians, because they are understanding the new realm of neuropolitics, or the role of emotion, which actually we can go back to that very current sort of neuropolitician, Aristotle, who told us that if you want to win debates in a world where the sound bites are now 4 to 6 seconds, you don't rely on logos, which is reason, you rely on pathos, which is emotion. And I think that still is the critical ingredient of the storytelling. And unfortunately, for better or worse, that bumper sticker simplicity, which the politicians have figured out. You know, the other final interesting point I thought on the micro-targeting stuff is, yeah, they do all these really cool random comparisons to see which of 10 messages survives. But when you go through those analyses, almost invariably, the ones that survived were the universal messages. It wasn't the one targeted at, you know, some very specific group of some micro-segment. They may have found it appealing, but it was the targets to overall populations and societies which were the ones which ended up being the most resonant.
And that leads perfectly into the question I was going to ask David, because you brought up the idea at the beginning about the importance of having a meta-narrative, as you said, for the campaign. When you get into a campaign where there are increasingly many, many voices, instead of just the boys on the bus, now you've got minibuses all over the damn place and filled with people chattering away. How do you create a meta-narrative, as Frank said, finding that single thing that is going to stick from one end of the country to the other, which seems to be in contradiction to the idea of the micro-targeting? Can you sort of put those two together?
Well, first of all, I think media remains a big part of doing that. And media framing is a big part of that story. And media are very important at telling people what to think about and what the campaign is about. And if I could just offer one sort of parenthetical thought on the conversation that you just had, I find people are incredibly interested in what ought to be the work of politics, which is, why is kids' education so expensive? Why are wait times at the hospital so long? Why can't my kid get a job? Those things that people are tremendously interested in. They have nothing but, and I did a survey, I see Herschel Esmond here, did a survey for Ryerson University about politics. They have nothing but contempt for the political process. And so when they say that they're not interested in politics, that's what they mean. And unfortunately, as journalistic resources have diminished, there's more and more concentration on the minutiae of politics as opposed to the outproduct of it.
My God, are you telling me that issues actually matter?
They really
matter.
That's what people actually care about.
Yeah.
And those bumper sticker slogans that we're deriding are designed to penetrate through a lot of barriers to deliver a message about substance, a message about what you can expect different from one political party over over another.
But is there a difference, David, between substance and, as Frank called it, the pathos, that emotional nugget that seems to work?
Yeah, I think presumably a lot of people here have read a book in the last couple of years called Thinking Fast and Slow, and certainly made me think a lot about the communications work we did around the Martin budgets in the 1990s and even the political campaigns we ran in the early 2000s, and thinking that they were probably too, and people may laugh at this, too rationally based in communications and not emotionally enough based communications. And there's no doubt that the emotional side of things, but that isn't divorced of substance. That's just involved in priming the issue to a level of importance. But the thing we're not talking about here that is a critical part of every campaign is advertising. Mm-hmm. And whether it's television advertising, which remains the mainstay of things, or whether it's digital advertising, which is an increasing part of the story, one of the ways you can set that meta-narrative is through advertising. And campaigns that have successfully driven a large narrative through a campaign have done so with a combination of leveraging what they get out of earned media into their paid media part of their campaign.
So, Adam, here we have the campaign managers, and I mean, there's nothing new in this question, but here we have the campaign managers framing the question, trying to frame the ballot question, trying to frame what you and Susan and I are going to write about. But as a journalist, I mean, our instinct always is, don't tell me what to write. I'm going to find out what I'm going to write about. And so that is always the creative tension between the two sides.
It is. And we can't pretend that what they're saying doesn't matter. I mean, that is ultimately they're making their pitch, and we have to assess that. I mean, I think the value we can bring there, I think partly the value has to come even before the campaign, if you're going to cover it well. I think we have to, certainly I'm trying to make a project of it. I think a lot of people do. Talk to the people who work on the campaigns, talk to the people who will be on the ground, understand what they're doing so you can recognize what they're doing when they do it and explain it properly. Again, this is more from an analysis or kind of commentary point of view. It depends what your beat is. But I think that's an important thing, is to provide context to what's happening. Because if we don't, if we are not the essential medium for them, and for some parties at least we're not, I think what we have to do is explain what else is happening, pull it all together, maybe help form a narrative there. And it's going to get more. I mean, we've sort of been going back and forth, I think, here on how micro-targeted it is or how diffuse it is. And I think it's important to distinguish there. I mean, there's wave elections where something like Alberta or even the last federal election happens, where something suddenly, hits. And there's ones where it really is, all the little battles matter, like 2008 might be a little more like that federally. So it's important to distinguish there, and the work we do depends on what happens. But I think it's going to get more and more diffuse. I mean, I don't think there's any way around that. Look, I don't think parties are very good at using all the new technologies, all the new mediums that are out there to reach broader audiences. I think the way our political messaging works in most parties isn't really conducive to getting digital audiences interested. I think they're going to have to get a lot better at that. But I think realistically, they're probably going to get better at it, and they're going to get better at delivering messages to individual people. And I know there's lots of, there's all sorts of social media companies floating around Ottawa trying to sell the parties on every last thing they can do with that, and they're going to get better at it. And so what I think we can do, I mean, if we're talking about narratives here, is we're going to have to try to pull all that together a little bit and make it all make sense a little more, because it's not going to get any easier to understand. I think that's where we come in, is, we don't just write the narrative that the one narrative they're telling us. We pull together the many narratives that are out there into something that is actually coherent.
So, Susan, putting all that together then, and I want to get back to David and Frank in a minute to outline what you guys think is going to be the attempt at the meta-narrative for the parties, so we know what to expect. But what's the stories that are going to matter, Susan? From our perspective, what are those stories that are going to matter in this coming campaign?
I like what David had to say, and I was really struck by a number of polls, to David's and also one that was done for the Broadbent Institute, which is really making it clear that Canadians do hate politics but like government. And in an ideal world, I would like to see an election that sort of focuses our mind on that. Are we going to have an election? This would be one I would enjoy covering. about the role of government in people's lives. That would be a very interesting election to me. And I think we've got some different views on the table here. And I think we've had 10 years of talking about tax cuts and taking government out of people's lives. And I think Canadians may be ready for a conversation about what is the role of government in your life.
But how do you do that in the cauldron of a federal election campaign where there are polls almost every 20 minutes, the rolling polls, the daily polls, the weekly polls, everything. And it becomes almost part of the meta-narrative coming out of the parties, especially if you're winning. Part of that is the polling. Part of that is the horse race.
They're mostly wrong. Eh? You could ignore them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're mostly
you're right.
Wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you just make them up like Frank does, you know what I mean? Of course, yeah. Yeah.
Three in a row.
What I would really like, and I've been saying this, is after every election where the pollsters are surprised, you hear it or you see it on Twitter or hear the reaction, why did the journalist call it wrong? Why didn't the journalist see this coming? And I would like to disabuse the public, our readers or whatever, of the notion that we call elections. I don't think it's our job to say who's going to win. I think it's almost cheating to say who's going to win an election. I think we should keep our eye on the ball and let the voters decide who's going to win the election. And we should be, once you start predicting, you start gaming your coverage to make yourself right. So I would like every journalist to make a resolution in this campaign not to say who's going to win, right? It's not our job.
But what do we do with all those pollsters that we've hired?
We're not hiring pollsters.
It's our job.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, but Adam, pick up the thread here, yeah. If you could.
I mean, I think, look, in principle, I wish that we didn't have to cover polls that much. I think it would be nice if we didn't. I also know a couple of things. One, it seems to be what audiences are interested in hearing. I mean, there's no way around that. And look, I'm aware I can write a long think piece about something, and I'm fully aware that the story that I write on some poll is going to get more traffic. It's just reality. That being said, I also think there's some importance there. Now, maybe we can all wish there wasn't, but look, we live in a first-past-the-post system. A lot of people are going to try to decide how to vote based on who has a chance to win. There's no way around that. There are a lot of people, for instance, who would be wavering between voting Liberal or NDP in this election based on which party has a better chance of beating Stephen Harper. So the polls that we run do matter. Now, we could declare a moratorium, I guess. I don't know how that would work in an era when there's all that information available online. But unless we're going to do that, I think we have to cover that stuff. I think we have to get better at covering it. I mean, the problem we have, as David would certainly be able to attest, is that our polling, certainly on horse race stuff, simply isn't as sophisticated as the stuff the parties are using. We poll in a different way. They don't do a general poll where they're polling across the country, including ridings, which are a foregone conclusion. They poll individual ridings. And they do a proper sample there, and they have a good sense of how it's going to go. They poll other metrics that we don't poll. They make a bigger investment than we make, which is often nothing. It's often free polls. So I think if we're going to do it, I don't think we can get away from it. I think we have to do it better. I mean, I think, you know, we can't pretend that opinion research doesn't matter. We can't pretend that voters don't want to know what their chances are. If we had a different electoral system, maybe, but the one we have, I think our obligation is maybe, you know, if we're talking about where we invest less, and if that's, you know, on the campaign buses eventually or other things, maybe a bigger investment in doing opinion research right is something we should actually be doing.
And, you know, I mean, here's one thing that strikes me, though, is that we all say, and I think we mean it all sincerely, is that substance matters, and that everybody in the process would like us to pay more attention to the matter of government rather than the matter of politics. That said, in this town right now, every single party and everybody involved in every single party is involved in one thing, and that's the horse race. Every campaign room, every minister, every opposition leader, all they care about is the horse race, because that's what it's all about. Everything else are ornaments on the tree. How do we win this horse race? Well, let's put out a policy. Maybe they'll like the policy, and then they'll win. You know, I mean, so, you know, and Frank, maybe I can throw this to you, both to you and David, because you've got the perspective on it, but as much as we want that to be the message, is it even realistic that in a campaign that substantive matters of policy can dramatically change votes?
Well, I think they can, absolutely. And I think the reason the horse race is so riveting is because it's often connected to fundamentally different visions about the role of the state and the kind of society you want to live in, the kind of values you think should define your society and that you want to hand off to your kids. So these kinds of questions really are inextricably connected to the horse race, which is why it's so intoxicating.
But to quote Kim Campbell, is a campaign any time to discuss serious policy?
Well, I think you have to have your issues down to a lot, such a level of elegant simplicity by the time you get to the campaign that people already have some sense of those. And you were alluding to the question of what might those be. And for whatever I've lost in my ability to come up with new ideas, I ask the same questions repeatedly in a semantically consistent fashion. It allows me to see how things change through time. This game's going to run out of runway in a little while in the future. But in the meantime, I see some very, very interesting things. We don't live in the same society at all that we lived in not so recent past. And one area which things have changed fundamentally, and these are all interconnected, is a sense that the way our economy works, the way our democratic institutions work, is just not working the way it used to in the last half of the 20th century. That the basic bargain, that if you work hard, if you invest skill, that you'll be a participant in shared prosperity and move ahead, has fallen apart. It really has. We find that, for example, today 17% of the public tell me, I'm better off than I was 4 years ago. We find that when we ask people, are your kids going to be better off? We've got 13%, a little better than the 9% we see in the United States. But the whole idea was that we would achieve improvements and progress, and that has collapsed. And I think that is what is really gnawing at people and why we look at things, and you look about that debate about the role of the state, for example. It sounds like an arid academic thing. But I believe that the Ontario election was very much based on that master narrative. Do you think that we should engage in further rounds of austerity, you know, some variation on trickle-down economics, or do you think maybe government should weigh in a bit more, should it cushion some of the effects of a tough economy, and maybe even try and get it going by investments in things like infrastructure and so forth, and forget the orthodoxy that, you know, austerity is the key. When we look at those things through time, and that may be why, frankly, a tired regime, which was suffering from a lot of regime fatigue, came off with a very surprising majority. Because when we track this through time, the public's receptivity to that bumper sticker simplicity of lower government, less taxes equals prosperity for all, has really evaporated. There's still a number of folks out there that buy it, but it's increasingly a smaller and smaller share. So they don't know what the answer is, but they're looking for something really different because they don't want to be, we don't want to be telling this generation, sorry, that whole progress idea is not on for you.
David, from your perspective, is there that elevator pitch narrative that is substantive enough? And if so, what would it be? And I won't ask you to speak on behalf of the Conservatives or the NDP, but for the Liberals, is there that core message that can move the vote? And let me anticipate my own supplementary on this, and that is to say, one thing that hasn't come up, but if we're talking about the disengaged young, is the environment. Climate change, the thing that can invigorate a new generation.
Well, actually, on that last point, just to bust a myth, I know that everybody always thinks that the environment is a young person's issue and that it's what motivates young people. I've done a lot of research in that area for a long period of time, and the evidence is clear. Young people are not the keepers of the environmental flame, and they are not the chief fighters of climate change. Women are. Particularly middle-aged women, are the most environmentally conscious people in the country and the people that are driving the environmental agenda the hardest. To go back to your main question, I think that what a lot of this is missing is what happens before the election campaign, before the writ, all the positioning that the parties do in that period of time. The extent to which Kim Campbell is right, and I would really hate for her to go down as an oracle of Canadian politics, but the extent to which he's right is that we have a saying, which is if you're in a campaign, if you're explaining, you're losing. So you want to be persuading, not explaining. You don't want to be on the defensive about something and getting into the weeds about trying to convince somebody of the merits. You have to have done that in advance, so that the campaign is a reminder and a prompt and getting your issue to the top of the to the top of the priority list for people. And I do think, to pick up on what Frank was saying, that the Ontario election is an example of that. Kathleen Wynne laid out her strategy and her narrative a year in advance. Everybody could see it coming a mile away through the fall economic statement, through a series of speeches, through the budget rollouts and the budget. It was evident what she was running on, and nobody in Ontario that was following politics was confused about what her government was about. And then the campaign started, and the other two parties made it clear what they were about, and there was a real battle engaged. Now, they may not have done that very effectively, and from my standpoint, you rarely have people, opponents, who play their part in your strategy as effectively as certainly Tim Hudak did. But nonetheless, much of the underpinnings of our campaign were being put in place a year in advance. And you can see Mr. Harper has been doing the same thing for well over a year now. He's going to run on safe hands. He's going to run on, he's the only person that can be trusted in this difficult economic time, in this uncertain secure world of security. He's the only adult that you could put in charge of the operation. And he has been putting the issues in place, putting the issues in the window, running the advertising, all of which reinforces those messages. He's not waiting to the campaign to start doing that.
Yeah. Ed, do you want to go on with the NDP and the Liberals?
No, well, I'm sure everybody has.
But creating that narrative.
Mr. Trudeau's announcement last week. Mr. Trudeau is, Gerald Butts is here. If he wants to come up and expand on this, he could do it. But Mr. Trudeau is clearly going to run on a platform of fairness. And of, as Frank said, many Canadians are increasingly of the view that the economic system is throwing off unfair results for people. And that working people are getting a diminishing share of the economic pie. Mr. Trudeau's campaign is going to be about addressing that. And the policy announcement last week, it's unusual to lay out an important part, and I would be surprised if that wasn't one of, if not the biggest elements in their platform. It's interesting to lay that out 5-6 months in advance of an election campaign, but they did that again to build the pre-positioning and the foundations for that.
Let me just jump in. If that is indeed the core message, and we'll find out from Jerry later on tonight, but Frank, I mean, pick up the thread and go to the NDP now, because isn't that more or less what the NDP pitch is going to be as well?
Well, one of the problems that from the electorate's point of view is that they're, at least at this stage, mildly flummoxed as to what exactly are the differences between the NDP. Do we either have two NDP parties or two Liberal parties? And a lot of the perceptions are, you know, of them as relatively substitutable. You've got a big group of promiscuous progressive voters that are very unhappy with things, and you know they're kind of shopping at this stage, and they can move, as we can see, in large numbers. But I don't think that's really become clear at all what is going to happen at this stage. It's extremely unclear. What I think is interesting, though, to go back to the issue of messages and information and the possibility that the journalism takes a smaller voice, you know, by the exigencies of budgets, restraints, and so forth. Well, that void's going to get filled by a lot of other sources. We know that, for example, that extremely well-financed political campaigns are capable of direct delivery now. They have their own studios, their own messaging. They don't have to go through, and they would prefer, frankly, to not go through the media unless they can actually use them to good effect. One area, though, that I'd like to raise is the whole issue of setting the message, setting the frame, is the role of advertising, but not necessarily paid political advertising, unpaid political advertising, the parts that the Government of Canada might do. We find right now that is overwhelmingly the dominant message about politics and public issues. It outstrips the Stanley Cup, it outstrips Duffy, and it outstrips paid advertising by like a dramatic margin. And the announcements of the other leaders aren't really penetrating the noise floor because it is, and it's not necessarily recognized that this is all sort of messaging, and some of it isn't, some of it's legitimate government messaging. But we also find that maybe there's an exposed flank in that. For example, I recently tested, I just got the thing in the field now, and we find only 10% of Canadians disagree with the proposition that is actually shouldn't happen. They don't think it's a good idea for paid advertising to be used, even if it's remotely and directly linked to sort of partisan interests. But it is extremely effective. So then when we go on and look at Mr. Harper, he has, even though he's not in the position to repeat power, he scores best on the guy who reflects my values, because he talks about values consistently and repeatedly. And he also seems as the guy that clearly has the clearest plan. Well, you know, that's because basically they've been simplified, repeated messaging. Now, the tough part is, despite all that repeated, simplified messaging and dramatic resources put toward it, they're still having trouble getting over 30 points. So you've got to wonder, you know, once the other games can join, how that'll have played out. But the messaging stuff is absolutely critical at this stage.
Okay, I want to go to Adam here, but as I do, I want to say that there are two microphones in the room. Please join the conversation. The only thing I would suggest is that if you are going to be speaking, I'd like to hear a question within about the first 20 seconds. Otherwise, I might call you on it. As people are doing that, Adam, Susan, at least from the panel point of view, last word to you. So those are from two of the best in the business, David and Frank, sort of laying out what the proposition argument is going to be for the three main parties. Do we then go and test those propositions, or do we go off on our own? Well, test the validity of that proposition messaging.
I'm a little biased this way, but I would like to see more journalism. I'm fond of journalism that is less about what the politicians are saying to the voters and what the voters are saying to the politicians. And I'd like to see a little more balance about that this campaign. I expect I'm not the only one. I think you're going to see journalists spending a lot of time in the new ridings, the 30 new ridings, to figure out not what the message is from the politicians to the voters, but what those people, because right now, as Adam has alluded, they have more tools than ever to know what people are saying and thinking. This election, the one that's supposed to be different from everybody else, but in 5 years, it is true that there are methods just beyond polling for, finding out who their supporters are with, you know, sending congratulations for birthdays and all that stuff. They've got all these ways of knowing who their voters are, what they're thinking, and I think I'd like to see some journalism that gets out there and says, what's the what are they saying back? What are those people in Brampton or the new ridings telling to the politicians? And we can do that. We have the technology.
And just before we go to Laura, Adam.
Yeah, I think first of all, for the record, I went and knocked on doors in Brampton in the last provincial election. Didn't get me very far. There were like three people home in the neighborhood I went to, which have kind of underscored the difficulty of that. I mean, the most important area of the country politically is the GTA. It's basically the hardest people to reach. They're commuters who are barely home. English may be a second language. They're not terribly comfortable in having somebody turn up at their doorstep to ask them questions. So it is a real challenge. I think in terms of our role. I mean, now it varies. I mean, there is certainly a fact-checking element. I think we should get better at the fact-checking element. I think, you know, we have the resources to do that in ways that, you know, this is one advantage of people who are actually paid to commit journalism is that there are the resources to spend time looking into things. And, you know, there's been efforts like in the U.S., I think it's the PolitiFact, which basically, you know, has done in sort of a grabby way going through things and saying, is this true or not? And I think that actually is a value when people hear something and they may just Google it and say, does this make any sense? There is a role for us there. I think there's a role, I mean, in the way that I guess I would approach it more personally, to contextualize what we're seeing, to explain to people what all the noise is. We talked a lot about all of the, or at least a little bit now, but about what issues are going to come up. I think trust is probably the biggest factor in judging, particularly with an opposition leader, but generally. And what we do matters, I think, in that sense, not just during the campaign, but leading up to it. I sort of wrestle with this because a part of me thinks all the stuff now is noise and nobody cares. And I think that's probably true of most voters. I do think that we have a role. The same people who are covering the stuff between elections are the ones who cover elections, and for the in large part. And I've certainly noticed covering in Ontario, it's my frame of reference, I apologize to people who are not from Ontario or don't care about Ontario, but a frame of reference here, I mean, I look back at several elections in Ontario, the last several, and, you know, you go into the 2003 election, and I think there's a broad perception in the general public that the Dalton McGuinty is kind of a loser. He's, you know, how he'd been branded in the previous campaign. Media are watching him in between elections. They say, oh, the guy's actually improved a little bit. Campaign starts. He has a competent first couple weeks, certainly more competent than his opponent. And, you know, the narrative kind of sets in, okay, this is a new McGuinty. And I think that does translate out a bit. A couple opposition leaders recently in Ontario, I mean, I look back at 2007, 2011, Tim Hudak, and before his first election, and his campaign, his people were doing all these crazy stunts before the election, try to get attention, and say, why are you doing all that? You know, why is he out with a big tax wheel and all this other stuff that looks ridiculous and makes him look not like a premier? They said, look, our only job here, you guys don't care about this stuff. You guys have all seen the messages already. The only thing that matters here is getting people's attention. It's really hard to do that. Yeah, except that then the campaign starts, and if he plays the type a bit, all the journalists have been watching him thinking the guy's kind of juvenile and unsubstantial, then zero in on it and start hitting him on it. And then in the last Ontario election, you had Andrea Horvath coming in, I think, with fairly well regarded by the Ontario public, the extent they knew who she was. And journalists watching the run-up had sort of watched her and said, oh, you know, she's not saying anything. You know, she has good days and bad days. She doesn't seem that, she's just not performing very well. First few days, she doesn't perform that well, but not terribly. And the narrative kind of fits in that she's an also-ran and doesn't matter. And that stuff does seem to trickle out and translate out. So I think all that is to say that I think the information that we gather in the run-up to campaigns actually does have some relevance once they begin, because people are going to look to us to make sense of it a little bit. And so whether it's stuff that we're reporting on the leaders, whether it's the strategies that are evolving, whether it's the consistency of their messaging, and whether that holds up during the campaign, I do think that's where the relevance is. I just think it becomes more and more important to actually do our homework so that we're not just pontificating once the campaign starts.
I want to go to Laura and also encourage, because we've got in the room tonight, just in case you don't know, and I can only see the first couple of bros, but some legendary performers in this whole industry. I'm looking at George Fracor over there, Herschel Ezrin over there, and so I encourage some perspective as well. Laura Peck.
Hi. Since Rachel Notley did so well in the debate, does that mean that debates really do matter? And any of the panelists can answer that question.
Well, a cynic might say that Rachel Notley did well, but also Prentice did badly. You know, you can look at that. Debates, of course, matter, I think, because they engage people. But was it Prentice and the bad math, the math thing, and the fact that clip traveled all over the place, did that do Prentice in? Or did people sit down in front of their television sets and say, hey, that Rachel Notley's not so bad? And I think, you know, it's one of those Rorschach tests for what do you think voters care about? And if you think that they sat and watched the whole debate and took the measure of Rachel Notley, I'm not sure about that. I think that the gaffe of Prentice during that debate. I could be alone in that.
David, I just want to go to David, because you've been in the back room of these debates a lot. What do you think?
I think they almost always matter. I think in almost every election, the debate's an important factor in a significant number of voters. Media often miss that because they're looking for a knockout punch. They're always looking for the I had no option moment. That moment is not always there, but that doesn't mean that people haven't drawn conclusions from the course of the debate. I had a focus group of people with real-time dials watching the leaders' debate in the Ontario election, and the fundamental thing that those people took away from the debate was that one of those people was an authentic person and one of those people was an inauthentic person. So people that were scoring the debate on points thought that Tim Hudak won the debate, but it was evident to us that Kathleen Wynne had won the debate. People use it as a source of information all the time. So I think debates are very important. And I think this election, they're going to be more important than perhaps even normal, which is why the Conservatives are anxious to have those debates on their own terms in their own territory. The Liberals need the debates to close the sale on Justin Trudeau. and the conservatives need the debates to demonstrate their central point that only Harper can be trusted with this operation. And I think Canadians are actually interested in the answers to both of those questions themselves, and will be looking to the debates for answers to them.
Just a quick observation. I agree with those points, but I think that the hard research suggests that in terms of qualitatively shaping the outcome and altering the outcomes of elections, it's extremely rare for a debate to actually shape the final outcome. You probably count on your one hand the number in North America of outcomes which have actually been, according to the experts, shifted. Now, having said that, the debates are critically important because they are the single most watched event in the campaign, and the stakes are so enormously high, because you can actually, even though you might not be able to win the debate decisively,
you can sure lose it.
Yeah. And that's basically where they do tend. But when they have effects, the effects tend to often either reinforce what trends that were going in, or if they are contrary, they tend to dissipate by the time people get to the ballot box. That's what the hard academic evidence says. But as I say, in terms of other things, intangibles impacts on morale, media coverage, framing, and all those, of course, they are critical, and they are by far the most single watched event. They are enormous, they're spectacle. So of course they're extremely important.
Did you want a word on this?
Yeah, quickly. I think what Frank said there about how they reinforce views, I think that jumps out at me as well. It's funny because we spend so much time talking about how people don't pay attention to campaigns that much or pay less attention than they used to. But for whatever reason, it does seem as though they tend to fit a narrative to reinforce impressions. I mean, as David said, Tim Hudak, to my eyes watching, well, I thought he performed quite well in the last Ontario debate. It didn't matter. Something about him people didn't like, and it drove it home. You know, Michael Ignatieff wasn't that much of a disaster in the federal debate, but somehow it fit that narrative. It was already evolving and emerging, or fit whatever impressions they had. The other thing I would just say as a journalist is there's nothing during a campaign I hate more than covering a debate. Bar none. I mean, particularly if you're supposed to do analysis of it, because you're trying to write the thing before the debate's even over, so you're barely paying attention to the last half of it, and you're supposed to have a quick take. And the problem is, I'm not the audience. I mean, that's what makes it hard for us to judge these things. I know these folks, I cover them. I can watch it and say, oh, Hudak's doing really well. This is the best I've seen him, and Wynn looks pretty shaky to me, and all of that. That's not a good barometer. So this is again somewhere where, if we have quality opinion research right after debate that media is paying for or getting, it would actually be helpful. It shouldn't necessarily be all of our coverage. But you know, this whole who won or lost, I'm probably the worst person to tell you that during a debate.
Jen, you've been waiting at the microphone. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen, I'm with Equal Voice. I have actually another question pertaining to debates. I'm wondering how much you folks wonder, especially Susan as a woman, how much it matters that we haven't had a debate on women's issues since 1988, the year I was born, actually. And I'm also curious how much you feel it matters that there's really been no concrete across-the-board definition on what it means to be middle class. And, you know, like rhetorically and platform-wise, that seems to be the primary conversation.
Those are huge questions, Jen. Well, obviously, I think something happened around 93 after the two federal parties had women leaders that didn't work out for them. It was sort of the tried it once, didn't work thing. That the idea of women's issues, women's leadership, and all of that just disappeared from Ottawa. The notion of women's leadership didn't disappear, and the importance of it didn't disappear, but it just fell off the agenda. I'm not sure it's going to come back, to be frank. I think that that there are all kinds of constituencies now that argue, I won't go into that. What was the second part of your question?
Middle class.
Well, I think the confusion there is because is it a number or is it a state of mind, right? Is middle class an aspiration or a culture, or is it an income figure? And I think that's why this has become confused.
And isn't it true though that even those who make $600,000 a year will tell you that they are middle class?
That's right. Yes.
In other words, I'd like to find somebody who identifies as not middle class.
Well,
that's right.
Actually, there is a pretty tight correlation between how people define themselves. And I agree. I presented at a International Conference on the Middle Class at Queens this summer, and the gentleman from the OECD reminded me that he had 158 definitions of the middle class, all of them income-based. Ours is much simpler. We simply ask people where they locate themselves, and we have different versions of it, some more complex. But the important point is, there's two important points. First, the incidence of people who locate themselves in the middle class in both Canada and the United States has dropped in lockstep from about 10 years ago to being 70% to being under 50%. That's when you ask the question at the same time. So whatever it means, and it has a meaning, and it is connected to income and other things, it's a much shrunken middle class than what it was. The second thing that we found is that the incidence of people who feel that the middle class, what the middle class means, has also shifted. So the middle class for the last half of the 20th century was seen as something where I work hard, I get a car, then I get a house, I do better than my parents, my kids do better than me, I retire securely. The American dream, Canadian dream, they basically work the same way. And so what happened though? Now all of a sudden people feel the middle class isn't about those things, it's about security, and security that no longer exists. People feel that their jobs aren't particularly secure, their retirement's not secure, their ability to take care of their family's not secure, and the idea that they're gonna go ahead is clearly not true anymore. So this is why I think the issue is so important, whether or not we argue about which labels to use or which categories. It is, for example, just one final point. Only 4% of Canadians think that if you don't have a growing optimistic middle class, you will not have societal health and economic progress. Only 4% disagree with that. 90% or 88% think that the middle class is neither growing, it's neither optimistic, and that it's falling backward. So if you put those two things together, we have a problem.
The short way of saying that, if you don't mind, is that the middle class dream, it's the dream part that was important. It's not the arguments about what is the middle class. What the politicians, I believe, are arguing about is where is the dream of the middle class now? And that's, I find that more interesting than defining what the income is.
Or as President George Bush the first said, that vision thing.
That vision thing, yeah.
Herschel Ezrin, thanks for getting up to the mic.
Thank you. And thank you to the panel for raising a lot of wonderful issues today. I'd like to ask a question about the impact on media coverage of two things. The seeming tendency in elections these days to have vote shifts in the last week or 10 days of a campaign, and what does that mean for media coverage? And the second is, and Adam, you raised this point actually, how do you deal with the subterranean campaign? And by that I mean the campaign that's not in English or French. Because on all the campaigns that I've been working on in the last 10 years, the language issue, and it's going on in Hindi, and Punjabi, in Arabic, and in a lot of other languages, is in fact a very formidable one, and the parties are spending a lot of time on it.
Can I just start off by saying that, on that last point, I thought it was fascinating that the New York Times did a deep investigation of abuse within the community that does nails in New York. And in the New York Times, they printed it in Korean, in Japanese, and in Chinese, I believe. I may have those languages wrong, but they printed in various languages. Anyway, the question was to you, so go ahead.
It's hugely important. I think on the second point first, I mean, I think the cultural media, whatever one wants to refer to it as, is hugely important. I think. Now, how important it is to campaigns, I find that there are, in terms of the actual outcome, I find there are mixed views among people who work on campaigns. Some of them say, oh yeah, it's hugely important. Other ones say, yeah, it's important, but don't overrate it. It's certainly important to me because the messages that are being sent out, they're not contradicting their own policy usually for a party, but they're framing it very differently. And they're going to lengths. I mean, the most obvious example probably being some of the ads that conservatives have run on social issues in certain language media, where they're using, whether it's in the past on issues around transgendered people or whether it's on drug policy or other things, just in much different tone than you get elsewhere. Our responsibility there, I think, it's pretty straightforward. I think we have to do a better job of monitoring it. I mean, the parties monitor it. The parties pay services to monitor it. I don't think that's beyond our, I don't mean to commit the Globe to anything here, but I don't think that's beyond our capacity at some point to do that. You know, it's not hard to find people who speak these languages who in some way can track them for us and at least give us some sense of what's being said out there. So I think that's an obligation. On the other point on the swings, The message to me out of that, I don't know how much it affects our role in that final week. I don't know. I think it is sort of that narrative coming together, and people will turn to us, and that, you know, I think that that again forces a bit of the importance there as things sort of pick up. People will look for a frame of reference or some context. The lesson to me out of that more is that we should probably stop pretending to know the frame of the campaign at the start, which we tend to do. We tend to say, oh, this is what it's all going to be about, and this is hugely important, and we make all these assumptions that, oh, you know, Stephen Harper couldn't possibly, he's doing well in Quebec, but he couldn't possibly have more than 10 or 15 seats there because that's not going to happen. Or the Liberals are, you know, they're trying to be more competitive in Alberta, but they're capped at 3 or 4 seats because, you know, there's no way Liberals don't win in Calgary suburbs. We really don't know that. And I think we have to be a little more willing to admit what we don't know and willing to admit that in a very, with a very non-tribal electorate, which I think we increasingly have, where party affiliation doesn't matter that much anymore, and where people don't pay close attention necessarily until pretty close to election day, things can go any which way, and we just have to be prepared for that and not pretend that we know going in what the narrative is.
Hugh Windsor.
I'd like to come back to Susan's comment that she would like to write more about government. But I want to pose the question to both Frank and David. Does style of government, per se, have any salience or impact? I mean, the business of ramming things through Parliament, of excessive secrecy, of sicking the Canadian Revenue Agency on the environmental NGOs. I mean, you can go on and on and on about the style of government. Does it have any measurable effect? And if so, what?
I think it depends on what it is. I think that probably the kind of people that come to an event like this would be disheartened about how little impact it has. And I think that a lot of the noise that's been made, for instance, about the Harper Conservatives' approach to institutions and to Parliament has not had any resonance with Canadians. And that's why I think it's a fair question for people to ask how much of that toothpaste will get put back in the tube when the government changes, or how much of this is actually the new normal because it's easier for the government and nobody seems to care about it. I think that there are two exceptions to that, and they both relate to when it stops being about politicians doing dirty things to each other, which is what people expect from politicians, and when it starts being about politicians doing dirty things to them, is when it changes. And so in the work I did on political ethics for the Pattison School at Ryerson, it was clear that when there was money involved, it became a different kind of issue for people. And it became a much heightened in importance, and people looked for different and more serious sanctions for people that were involved in enhancing their own financial situation at the expense of the public. The second thing, and this is where I think the Harper people are at risk, is when secrecy turns to trust. And when people start asking the question, why are they so secretive? And start to conclude it's because they don't trust us with the truth. They won't tell us the truth because they think that we would make a different judgment about them if we knew it. And when you get to that point, those kinds of behaviors really start to matter. But does prorogation matter? No.
Barry. Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm sorry, Frank. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's a terrific answer. I agree with everything you said. I do think there are other catalysts, though. I mean, when you look at some of the literature predicting whether incumbents are successful, there's people have gone back and analyzed all the UK, Canadian, and American elections, and they find there's three factors that tend to predict the success. One is the trajectory of the economy. Another is the approval rating for the government of the day and their leader. And the third, though, is regime fatigue, which is typically operationalized by length in time. So I think it as time goes on, you know, everything gets old, these things percolate and become a bigger problem. I think you can see some evidence of this when you start looking at some of those trajectory and approval things. The other catalyst can, of course, be when there is some event that puts a magnifying glass or shines a light on issues. For example, the sponsorship scandal, was really asked every day almost in the House for 2 years with little effect until it appeared before a commission, all of a sudden became Canada's favorite indoor sport and changed the political landscape in almost an indelible way for a decade. You know, will that happen? We haven't seen the evidence of that with the Duffy trial at this stage in time, but it has the earmarks of possibly being one of those things which will shift these things from, I completely agree that Canadians would probably be depressed, or people in this room be depressed, how little importance that is in terms of ballot booth issues. You know, oh, this is a mean government, or they're very thuggish with people, or they aren't very fair or nice. They are either unaware or don't care. But there are places where, through time, cumulatively, that can become a very big issue, and can also be, a fuse can be lit with a specific event which can draw attention to it at an inappropriate time for that government.
Just before we get to the next questioners, I just want to point out that nothing says that a panel is coming to an end faster than when they put the wine out on the back of the room. And so we really are on short final, as they say in the aviation business. So what I think I might do is, Barry, I'll go to you, and then you, sir, and then we'll come to the panel so that we can get a few more voices. So Barry McLaughlin, go ahead.
Yeah, great panel. Nobody mentioned tonight negativity, hyperpartisanship, and the role it may play in turning off the voter. First of all, is that true, that this is one of the causal factors to why people just turned off the political process? Is there an opportunity for any leader to come forward as not needlessly partisan, but actually tapping into the hopes and aspirations of Canadians?
Okay, let's hold that for a sec. Lawrence.
I'm Lawrence Wall from the CBC. I wanted to ask about the vulgar heckling of the City News reporter in Toronto earlier this week. 20 years ago, that story would have had a shelf life of 4 to 5 days, but in 2015, it had maybe 4 or 5 hours. So will that apply to the campaign coming up? Will we see not just one story per day, but perhaps 3, 4, 5 stories with Twitter and other social media speeding it through the normal course? What do you think?
And the connector between those two is that both were driven, I mean, the negativity portion that Barry was talking about, and of course that incident that Lawrence points out with the City reporter. Okay, who wants to jump in?
I'll give it with time. Adam talked about this too. I also have sat off the planes, and one of the things that bothered me, sitting in at Wenyang while all our best reporters were on the planes, was that all that stuff was happening out there while our best reporters were locked on a plane, right? And in an ideal world, what you want are your best political reporters. Yes, those are going to be 4 or 5 stories a day. I think the news cycle is now down to, well, I think we just missed one, right? It's every minute. So I think what the job of political journalists then is to find what the connecting thread is through those viral events or the 3, 4, 19 stories a day, and contextualize it for people who aren't.
Yeah, I mean, I think we reached peak short attention span a few years ago. I think if we're going to do our jobs well and provide a service, I think we have to get further from it even than maybe we were before the 24-hour news cycle, in that, you know, for people who want immediate news, there are outlets for that.
Twitter.
And you know what? Twitter, in a way, is almost I know there's a lot of cynicism about Twitter among people, particularly work in politics, about how it only plays to the chattering classes and so on. They're probably right, but you know, it's kind of a godsend, because if you cover something, you can tweet about it. If it doesn't merit a story, great, okay, you're done. Now spend 3 days actually researching a good story and write about it, right? I mean, I think there is that there where we can afford to take a little more time. The junkies can get it off of there, or other outlets, or a quick news file online or whatever, but there actually is a recognition that where we can provide a service is in taking more time. I guess I'll leave the other question about optimism to opinion folks who probably have a better sense of it.
Sure.
Just a quick comment. Yes, the new campaign styles are having a corrosive impact on trust in democracy. The public feel held hostage to these. They don't like it. They don't approve, but they don't know what to do about it. There's no question. We see the lowest numbers in terms of trust in political parties and the democratic process that we've seen in 50 years. On the second point, which is related, the impact of social media and the ephemeral shelf life of the issues as it drops from 4 days to 4 hours, the interesting thing there is people tell us by an overwhelming margin, even truer young people, that social media are liberating and helpful for democracy. When I look at it and analyze the impacts of who actually is consuming more and how that's connected with what they do in terms of democracy, I actually come to an opposite conclusion. I think that it was Neil Postman talked about amusing ourselves to death a long time ago. He probably would have had a picture of someone on Twitter on the cover instead of Reagan with the red rubber nose. This is the new Soma. The incidence of people, and this is a point that Kaiser makes in his really wonderful article in the Brookings Institution, is that what we have is a fragmentation now where people are increasingly in little compartments, you know, listening in echo chambers, drinking their own bathwater, and then they're completely surprised and shocked when things don't turn out the way that all their peers have told them at time and again so passionately they're right. Or else they will decide that I'll express my views on Twitter and Facebook, but I won't bother voting. And then again, surprised and perplexed that the world didn't change. So I think that's something that we really should look at a little more carefully and understand better.
And
to Barry's point, yeah. I have a slightly different take, and maybe it's understandable because I think probably few people in Canadian politics are as identified with negative advertising as I am. But I don't know that you can blame it entirely or even in majority terms for the decline in respect or perceptions of politics, because it feeds off that in addition to perhaps driving it. The reality is that it is much easier, given the cynicism that people have about politics, it is much easier for me to convince you that another politician is worse than you thought than it is for me to convince you that my politician is better than you thought. And in a 35-day campaign where you don't have forever to make your point, and if things are going badly for you, you got one chance to turn it around, these are the tools you have at your disposal. And people use these tools because they work. And they work because they are feeding into an existing sense that people are choosing between relatively flawed options and which option is more flawed than the other. And the sad case of many of the campaigns I've been involved in, because I've always loved the candidates I work for, I wish I didn't have to elect them through negative ads. I wish people carried them around on their shoulders and threw flower petals at their feet. But instead, my wins have tended to be messier than that. And but it's because people know that they are made. This is a relative choice. It's this or it's that, and what's wrong with that option can be at least or more compelling to people than what's right about that.
No, that's good. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the wine is there. I just say what great fun it's been to listen to four of the best in the political world: Adam Radwanski, David Hurley, Frank Graves, and of course Susan Delacourt. Thank you all very much.
Bonsoir, je suis Nathalie Turvey, la directrice générale de la Fondation pour le journalisme canadien. Au nom de la Fondation, je tiens à mon tour à remercier les membres de notre panel de s'être joints à nous ce soir. Nous sommes aussi très reconnaissants à notre superbe animateur Tom Clark d'avoir mené cette discussion intéressante et stimulante. Please join me in a round of appreciation for our speakers. This is a milestone year for the CJF. We're celebrating 25 years of working to preserve, provoke, and enhance excellence in journalism. Part of that mandate is this public speakers series, CJF J Talks, where we aim to take a deeper look at the role of journalism in our society and the challenges facing the industry. We're thrilled to be able to bring this series to Ottawa every year, thanks to the generous support of our partners. I'd like to thank Shaw, this evening's presenting sponsor, for making tonight possible. Our thanks to BMO Financial Group, our series sponsor, and our gratitude to the National Arts Centre for hosting us this evening. I owe one more very heartfelt thank you to CJF Program Committee member the tireless Hugh Windsor. Hugh has been with the CJF since its founding meeting in 1990 at the Niagara Institute, and he's very much the man behind tonight's event. So thank you, Hugh. On behalf of the CJF, thanks to all of you for joining us and supporting CJF JTalks. I'd now like to invite you to join us to continue the conversation at the cocktail reception. Merci et bonne soirée.